2000 on Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 254, The Prophet's Harem, A Look at Life in the Lion House. Participants Jeffrey O. Johnson and Todd Compton.
Good afternoon. I'm Sanford Barrett, and I am introducing our speaker today. I told a friend of mine that I was chairing this particular session. She said, "Oh, the one about the harem." I said, "Yeah, Brigham Young's harem." So our main presenter today is Jeffrey O. Johnson. Jeff is the director of Utah State Archives, where I understand he is in charge of an army of 35 archivists, or archiving-related employees, I suppose, where they take care of everything that the state of Utah needs to archive. Jeff has a bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University and with a major in history and a minor in library science. I was given a list of numerous articles that he had written in the past for various journals, and I stopped counting at about 28. I've noticed that he's published in Sunstone and Dialogue and Exponent 2 and a variety of historical history-oriented publications. I think this topic today, he's published a couple articles on before, so I think this must be his baby. After he gives his comments, we're going to hear from Todd Compton. And the biographical sketch I got on him was even briefer. He lists as his employment that he's a word processor and that he has two parents. And that he got a bachelor's and a master's degree from BYU and a PhD from UCLA. And modestly notes that his book, In Sacred Loneliness, won the Best Book of the Year award from the MHA in 1997. So I was given my choice of introducing many topics today, and I picked this one because I thought it sounded the most interesting. So,
it's an honor for me to be here today, and I appreciate you being here. I hope you have a chance to kind of discuss this subject. I've been working on this family, the Brigham Young family, for, I guess, 20 years. And part of that time, I published a few articles about it. What I wanted to do with this paper is to talk about the family and what life was like in the Beehive House. Because I think maybe understanding that helps us to understand these people that we're talking about. What got me involved in learning about Brigham Young's wives was the realization that most people didn't know anything about them. Non-Mormons saw them as in two ways, as beautiful courtesans or imbeciles who would get involved in this. And of course, Mormons saw them as perfect Mormon wives. And I think maybe none of these things are true, and kind of a mixture of all of those. I was working in the church archives at one time, and we got some letters that one of these wives had written her sister over the years. Her sister was not a Mormon. And I thought, what a wonderful, interesting person this woman was. We know very little about her because she had no children. But I've been finding things that people have said about her and things they remember about her. And recently I met a woman whose mother knew her, and this mother is still alive. So that was kind of exciting to me. The next thing I want to do, besides explain that, is to explain why the sources I used for this particular paper. I wanted to use sources that were from the people that were involved in this family. And that is, and I'll mention in the paper probably some reasons why, but that is very difficult because there's not very much. One of the wives, of course, Anna Eliza Young, wrote a book that was published and was really quite popular. But she was not very much involved in the family, and as you read in her book, she didn't have a lot of association with them. In fact, she says in the book that she only met Amelia Folsom, who she writes pages and pages about, only met her twice. So I haven't used her. Clarissa Young Spencer, a daughter of Brigham Young, wrote a book and with Mabel Harmon, and that was published. And I used a little bit from that. I have some concern about that because we're not sure how much of it is actually hers and how much is Mabel Harmon. So, and there are a few letters and reminiscences, and Emily Dow Partridge has written some stuff that is very wonderful that shows her relationship to the family. She's one of Brigham's wives. But the thing that I've discovered is some wonderful manuscripts by Susie Young Gates, Brigham Young's daughter. I think these were written as she was writing the biography of Brigham Young, which she published, but it was not used in the published work. And even though she's very supportive of Brigham Young and absolutely worshipped him, I think she also represents the attitude of her mother. Her mother was very much honored to be a part of the family. But even though there's that bias, I think there's some wonderful things that she says that we can hear about this this family. I start out with the title has the Prophet's Harem because people were very interested in this family. And Catherine Van Valkenburgh Waite, in 1866, this would be 11 years before Brigham Young died, published a very popular book entitled The Mormon Prophet and His Harem, or an authentic history of Brigham Young and his numerous wives and children. This book became widely popular, going through 6 editions and many printings in just 3 years. Mrs. Waite gives the public a fanciful view inside of Brigham Young's family life. She even includes diagrams of the rooms in the Lion House. A place where many people wanted to peek. But this was difficult for Brigham Young. On one occasion, Brigham Young complained, "Ladies who come into my office very frequently say, I wonder if it would hurt his feelings if I ask him how many wives he had. I would just as lief they should ask me that question as any other, but I'd rather see them anxious to learn about the gospel." Although Brigham Young said that he did not mind answering questions about his wives, he did not do it very often. His Victorian sensibilities apparently made it hard for him to talk about so sexual a subject as his relationship with his wives. And his Yankee independence bristled at the invasion of his privacy. He gave instructions to the church historian's office that, quote, he did not wish but little history of his family given. He was also concerned about the privacy for his children, who were growing up under the watchful eyes of both the Mormon faithful and the non-Mormon critics. And I think there's some evidence. I've been studying these children and wide variety, interesting, unique people. But I think this was a very difficult thing for them to have all this publicity. His children's activities were often noted in the press, including criticisms of many perceived misdeeds. In this paper, I'd like to investigate what it was like for those wives and children living in the household, and as I said, using sources from people that were there, but especially Susie Young Gates. I want to set a kind of a feeling for this household by quoting her when she talks about the Lion House, where she was born. The Lion House contained on the main floor 9 bedrooms and sitting rooms and a parlor or prayer room. These sitting rooms were occupied by the mothers of children, while the remaining childless wives had a sitting room and a bedroom upstairs. The lower basement contained a long dining room in the southwest corner, and that's where you can go today and eat. It's the cafeteria, which accommodated from 50 to 70 people at a meal. For all the help, the orphans, the visitors, and friends sit down together at 2 long tables. It was the building of the Lion House that allowed Brigham Young to bring his family together and allow them to live as a unit. In Nauvoo, because of the secret nature of plural marriage relationships, he could not have his family together. After they left Nauvoo, the reality of the trek across the plains made it impossible for them to form the family unit he wanted. Several women had been sealed to him in Nauvoo that left Mormonism, choosing not to come with the church leaders to Utah. Few died during the trek, while others left during this period to marry other men. After arriving in Utah, Brigham Young built a group of small log houses to house his family. This became known as the Old Log Row. He then built a house for his wife, Marianne Angel, and her family. This house, later known as the White House. This house, the White House, was her home until her death in 1882, 5 years after Brigham Young's death. The next house that he started was the Beehive House. It was started in 1854. And it was this home that became the official home for Brigham Young. It was the place where visitors were often entertained. And if you read accounts of people visiting Brigham Young, often they will be visiting in the Beehive House. After Marianne Angel rejected living there, it became home of his first plural wife, Lucy Ann Decker, and her family. She lived there with her children by her former marriage and her children she had by Brigham Young. Before the Beehive House was finished, the Lion House was started. This home was intended to be for those family members that were still living in the log row and others that were scattered throughout the city. The Lion House was very much needed, since by the time it was finished, Brigham Young had fathered 41 of his 57 children. So most of the children had been born before this. Two more children would be born the same year that the family moved into the house, including Sousa. It was Brigham Young's interest in economic issues that encouraged him to bring his family together. It was also his understanding of the doctrine that Joseph Smith preached in Missouri called the Law of Consecration. Young's continued interest in this economic experiment would be the basis for the United Order movement in the 1870s. He felt it was economically and socially better to have his family living together. And we'll discuss that later, because apparently he changed his mind at the end of his life. Sousa continues talking about the communal aspects of the living arrangement. She states that the Lion House was long and narrow, with 10 hooded dormers on each side pointing the sloping roofs heavenward. It had 3 stories with long, narrow windows, and it was obviously built for many people to live there. It was obviously built for this complex family, whereas the White House and the Beehive House had been built for one family unit. Sousa's mother, Lucy Bigelow, must have really wanted to leave the log row, since Sousa states that since Sousa was born March 18, 1856, before the house was quite finished. There were boards laid down for a floor, for mother was anxious to get inside before the birth. And Sousa was her second child. Most sources agree that the house was not finished until that summer. So Lucy got to move in March, but they kept working on it and didn't finish it until that summer. Samuel Ross Kelly, who worked for Brigham Young, remembered, "I did not continue to drive the team long as the president was finishing the Lion House." He had been driving the team for Brigham Young. "And he sent me to clean up and prepare the rooms for occupancy. I helped his family move into their new quarters. As winter approached, presumably the fall of 57, the president sent all his teams and men except me to Cottonwood to work for the winter, while he went to Fillmore as the governor of the territory to attend the legislature. Before leaving, he met me and told me to continue living at the Lion House and take care of his families, as I was the only man he was leaving around his premises, except the clerks in the office. Now, by this time, his children were very small, most all of them, or his older sons were adults. After the president had been gone a few weeks, the measles broke out among the children. We had a serious time. 9 were down at one time. For 5 weeks, I never took my clothes off except to change my underclothing. I was so exhausted. Sousa tells of an incident that happened just before her birth. So this would be a little bit before this. She writes about the death of 2-year-old Jedediah Grant Young, the son of Clara Decker. Sousa says, Mother loved him, and she could not be kept from his dining couch for days. Although the tiny soul was then unfolding his, her earthly body under her heart. In other words, she was developing in her mother's womb. They used to tell me that the occasional nightmares experiences I had were the fruits of mother's long death vigil over sweet little Jetty. Ross Kelly remembers the same incident. He says, Clara Decker Young's Jetty was very sick, and I exercised myself over him very much. But after lingering illnesses of several weeks, his spirit left his body to go to a better place. I remember that while conversing with Sister Clara after the death of her darling, the question of having faith in God was spoken of. She said, It has been a severe trial to my faith to lose my child in absence of his father, my husband. But it has taught me a lesson, to rely upon the Lord more and my husband less. For I do not know, but I have thought too much of my Brigham. This story has some interesting details which tell us much about the lives of Brigham Young's wives. First, that in such a large family, with the father of the family so busy, the women had to depend more on their own resources, and Clara says on her own relationship with her father in heaven. But the complete story also tells us that Clara had the emotional support of the other wives when their husband was gone. Lucy Bigelow was concerned enough to sit with Clara at her son's sick bed and be with her at his death. So she had this support. There are many examples of support given by different wives for the members of the family. Of course, the personalities of these wives and the circumstances affected the extent of that support. Sousa makes some interesting comments about these relationships. This first comment, which I find very interesting, is about Clara Decker. Clara is the wife who came with Brigham Young in the Pioneer, came across the Pioneer, in the Pioneer Company. So her statue's up at This is the Place Monument. She is also the mother of little Jetty, who died. This is what Sousa says about Clara. Clara was loved of father, and she was our intercediary. What childish desire was ever left ungratified if Aunt Clara found it out? Mother, speaking of Lucy Bigelow, was meek and might not ask for an extra childish wants. She was too conscious of many calls on father. But Aunt Clara was always known for the psychological moment which to approach father. So she could approach him at the right moment. And then she goes on to say, Aunt Clara's room was the gathering place of the clans. No matter where we had been or how late the hour might be, we all had to go to Aunt Clara's room to talk things over before one of us girls would go to bed. She's talking more about the daughters, the girls. No matter whose sitting room fires were out and whose mothers might be curled up asleep, Aunt Clara's fire was always bright. Aunt Clara was up waiting for us, quiet, sweet, sympathetic, and cheery, and we could put on the finishing touches of an evening of enjoyment by telling what he said and what she said and what had happened then. So Clara sat up, waited to talk to the girls before they went to bed. Apparently Sousa's mother went to bed, was asleep. An interesting one of the people that is very interesting in this family is Marianne Angel. She acted as the first wife. She's
not really the first wife of Brigham Young, because he was married, and just after first had two children, and then just after he joined the church, his wife died. And then he married Marianne Angel after they got to Kirtland. So Marianne Angel was really the first wife, as the others were plural wives. And what her relationship to the family has been very interesting to me. I've noticed in other plural families that I've studied, especially George A. Smith, that his first wife, Bathsheba Smith, was very much a key in how the families got along. But Marianne, apparently, I'll let Sousa tell you. Aunt Mary, who was father's first living wife, never lived in the Lion House. Indeed, I can't recall having seen her there, which is very interesting because so much of the family activity went on in the Lion House. I can remember her only up in the White House on the hill. She was a very stately lady, tall, dark, portly, in a day when portly was good, and very deliberate in her speech and manner. She was extremely courteous to all of us children, but never familiar, nor were we ever familiar with her. The next wife would be the first plural wife, Lucy Decker. Sousa makes some interesting comments about her. Remember, Lucy is the sister of Clara, who Sousa obviously really loved. But this is what Sousa says about Lucy, who is the first plural wife and in the Beehive House, not living in the Lion House. Aunt Lucy Decker was an excellent housekeeper and an accomplished cook. She was quiet in her demeanor, but was sometimes very sharp-tongued if tired or bothered too much when busy at her household task. I like to go over to the Beehive House, for I was very fond of Myra, that would be Lucy's daughter, and loved to play with her. But I was always careful to keep out of the kitchen and not to be noisy or troublesome. Sousa also says similar things about these other women who she lived around, and I think it's very interesting, and we can find other sources, people describing these women, but I'd like to say a few things about Zina Huntington. She says, was a sympathizer, a midwife, nurse, doctor, spiritual advisor, mother confessor to nearly all the family. Actually, Zina moved out quite early out of the Lion House. She talks about Susanna Snively, who lived at the farm. She says, she was one of those women we call a whiner. She could extract more things out of father through complaint than Aunt Clara could through her sweet tact.
What was that wife's
name again? Susan Snively. Susan is very interesting. If you go up to the Forest Farm home, that's the home she lived in. It's been moved up to this is the place monument. She adopted a daughter. She had no children of her own. A woman, and we think it was a woman that was going through Utah to California, had this baby, and she wanted to give it up. And so Sousa wanted to take the baby. She didn't have any children. But she insisted that the baby be born between her legs. So Sousa stood over this mother and took the baby between her legs. This baby, Julia, grew up thinking she was Brigham Young's daughter. And Sousa tells us that when she was a teenager, they were at a dance, and some of these rude boys told Julia that she wasn't really Brigham Young's daughter. She was just an adopted daughter. And Julia fainted. So that's Susanna Snively, who was the whiner. Sousa also comments on Eliza Snow, who we're very interested in. In the Lion House, and Eliza Snow seemed set apart. She was said to be cold and proud. But then Sousa could not say that about someone she admired so much. So she says, I never found her that way. She was my patron saint, and under her control and encouragement, all of my few literary and organizational gifts blossomed into fruition. You know, Sousa did write a lot. She was the editor of the Relief Society magazine, and she said all these things that she did. She really did a lot. In fact, they used to call her the 13th Apostle because she was involved in everything. She says, Lizar Snow gave her that. Then she describes the family prayer in the Lion House, which tells me that Marianne Angel didn't come down to family prayer. Her children were older. Some of them would be married. But in the Lion House, there was a clang of a bell. We all came downstairs and took our accustomed places, mothers surrounded by their children, while father sat near Aunt Eliza Snow, the honored plural wife of Joseph Smith, the prophet. A little merry or grave chat, questions asked and answered, and then quiet parental request, now come, let us have prayer. The prayer was always short and simple, but an earnest one. With a general amen, all of us resumed our seats and were at liberty to return to our rooms or to stay and hear the talking. She does, I didn't use this, she does have an example of when her little sister acted up during the prayer. And Brigham Young stopped the prayer and grabbed the little girl and spanked her and then set the little girl back down and started the prayer again. No, continued the prayer. It's significant that the household did not limit itself strictly to Brigham Young's wives and offspring, but managed its resources well enough to provide the needs of many people that were loosely connected to the family. They included adopted children, stepchildren. Many of Brigham Young's wives had children when they married him by previous marriages. Members of the extended family, Brigham Young's sister lived with them for quite a long time. Non-conjugal wives, which were part of the Young family. Heber J. Grant, whose father died when he was 6 days old, Heber was 6 days old, remembered frequently joining the Brigham Young family for evening prayers. He says, "From the time I was a little child, not more than five, until the day of Brigham Young's death, when I was 21 years old, he went to their prayers." He and his mother lived across the street in the 13th Ward. Sousa talks about Aunt Twiss. Aunt Twiss is the one that got me involved in this. Her letters are interesting letters to her sister in New Hampshire. She was in charge of the kitchen staff. She had no children and she loved her job. They had two hired cooks and two dishwashers to assist her. And she says she was a genius for management. Clarissa, who lived with her mother, as I've said, Lucy, next door, said, "Mother usually had two or more immigrant girls in her home. It seemed to me that father expected mother to always keep that many in training by teaching the English language and the household routine." This did cause a problem, though. James Moyle, in his autobiography, recounts that he liked Clarissa very much, but when he found out that she had never washed dishes, he decided he could not marry her. Sousa admits that they would have been better raised, indeed, father said so himself once to me, if each wife had had a home of her own and had brought up the girls in the science of housekeeping, its arts and labors. But having no particular kitchen or housework to do and going to school always, we wasted a good deal of the rest of the time in useless frolic. Of course, it was more economical to have us together, and it would cost a good deal to feed and clothe from 50 to 75 people. But she felt like, her father felt like that might have been a mistake. And when he's old, his daughters are marrying and having their first families, and I think he's seen that in his daughters, that they had all these people to wash the dishes and they didn't have to. I assume that Clarissa learned to wash dishes after she got married. As the children got older, the Lion House could not hold all the family, and several of the wives moved out with their children. Brigham Young bought the Jedediah M. Grant home on Main Street, where CCMI is today, for Emmeline Free's large family. She had 10 children by Brigham Young, so hers was the largest family. Emily Partridge moved out. Lucy Bigelow, Susan's mother, moved with her three daughters to St. George. And Eliza Burgess and her son moved to Provo. Nevertheless, the Lion House remained the center for the family. It was there where they stayed when they came to Salt Lake. It was there where they came for family parties. They would celebrate Brigham Young's birthday. And I put here after his death, but I was reading Annalisa again, and she was saying that they always celebrated Brigham Young's birthday in the Lion House, even when he was alive. So everybody came for his birthday. There were family funerals held there. Brigham Young died in the Lion House, and that's where he was, where people came to see his body, and his body was carried to the tabernacle for the funeral from the Lion House. Many of the widows eventually moved back to the Lion House when their children grew up and left home. And this is an interesting part of it that I want to study with these women. You see pictures of them, these elderly women living in the Lion House together, kind of supporting each other. It's also this Lion House that became the symbol for plural family life in Utah. And I understand that there are people like Harold B. Lee that wished the Lion House would have been torn down so people wouldn't remember polygamy when they came to Utah. Thank you.
Jeffrey added quite a few comments from his written paper that kind of, by inspiration, went ahead to what I was going to say. So, but I'll read through it anyway. No, they were very good. As I'm sure you'll agree, it was a pleasure to listen to Jeffrey's account of family life in Brigham Young's Lion House. His article on Brigham Young's Wives, Determining and Defining Wife, The Brigham Young Households, which appeared in the Fall 1987 Dialogue, is one of the real classics in Mormon history, kind of an unsung classic. And I referred to it constantly when I was researching and writing my book. The number of wives of Brigham Young is as fluid and hard to pin down as are Joseph Smith's wives, and Jeff did a wonderful job of bringing order to a subject marred by anti-Mormon sensationalism and lack of careful determining and defining. Believe it or not, there are some lists of Brigham Young's wives that go far beyond Johnson's 56. Is that 56? Is that?
The article said 55, but there are
56.
50. So you did, yeah.
And 57 children, that's where you are?
Yeah.
That's interesting. They're almost the same.
Isn't that amazing?
But, of course, he only had kids by, was it 20?
16.
16? Right, okay.
16 wives.
Right. Okay. Of course, as the title of his article shows, Determining and Defining Wife, you have to define what wife means before you can count them. In the insightful and well-researched paper we have just heard, Jeff gives us just a brief but fascinating glimpse into life behind the walls of the Lion House, showing that it was what it was like to be a child growing up there or a wife living there. For a paper like this, Jeff had to be extremely selective. He could have gone in many different directions, even confining himself only to the extremely rich Sousa Young Gates papers at the Utah State Historical Society. He could have highlighted other wives. He could easily have conducted an all-day seminar on life at the Lion House. And I would attend if he did that. And by the way, Sousa, as some of you may know, was a real force to be welcomed with, to be reckoned with, and he touched on that just a little bit. And I think she wrote the rough draft of her book on Brigham's household as therapy, and because some passages are extremely frank, and these frank passages were all edited out of the final book. So be careful what you write, even in your rough draft, because it could, you know, eventually come out like it's going to come out with Sousa Gates' papers. Jeff quoted one example when he said Susan Snively was known as the whiner. Sousa referred to another wife as a drug fiend, which probably means she had health problems and developed a dependence on pain-killing drugs, though Susan herself doesn't say that. And another interesting wife who comes fairly negatively out of the Sousa Gate papers, Sousa Young Gates papers, is Harriet Cook, who had an extremely sharp tongue. And maybe Jeff will tell us a little bit about her if we have time later. So this paper is a gentle, quiet account, though Jeff recognizes some problems in the Lion House, such as the girl's lack of housekeeping experience. And this paper focuses on life in the Lion House. And, of course, if you look at the wives individually, as they left the Lion House, much happened outside of it. But that Lion House was a really interesting little... what would you call it? Crucible of polygamy. So many great women lived there. Eliza Snow, Zina Huntington Young, Emily Partridge Young, Lucy Bigelow Young, and many others. And it's definitely one of the most fascinating buildings in Salt Lake City, filled with history, brought to life by Gates' wonderful descriptions. And to me, it is sacred ground. So I am troubled that the church merely uses it as a restaurant and a reception building. When I pay my respects to Eliza and Zina, as I always do when I'm in Salt Lake, I have to sneak in and wander around the second floor surreptitiously. And I think possibly the church ignores its rich historical value because it is embarrassed by polygamy, and the story we just heard from Jeff supports that, doesn't it? That Harold B. Lee would have liked to pull it down because of its associations with polygamy. I think possibly the church ignores its rich historical value, although I just read that. Okay, but because of the embarrassment of polygamy, I think that attitude undervalues the contributions of Eliza R. Snow, Zina Young, and many others. And Eliza and Zina are arguably the two greatest women in early Utah, of course. So surely the church could put plaques on the walls of the rooms saying who lived there, with pictures of the wives, if available. And I think the building deserves tours as much as the Beehive House does, and restoration just as much. It's really a wonderful building. I would like to take the opportunity of responding here to be the first one to ask Jeff a question. And we have accounts indicating that Emmeline Free Young was, according to some of these accounts, Brigham Young's favorite wife for... two decades, and she's the one who we mentioned who had 10 children. And I think that's the most of any wife, is that correct? Yeah. In fact, according to Waite, who was the non-Mormon who Jeff mentioned right at the beginning of his article, Brigham visited Emmeline's rooms so frequently that the other wives would line up at their doors and stare daggers at him as he walked down the hall to visit her. So, according to this account, which may be apocryphal, Brigham created a special hall that would take him directly to her room. So my question is, do you agree that Brigham did have a favorite wife or wives? Do you see that kind of dynamics going on?
Should I get up?
Sure.
Do you know, it's interesting, Sousa responds to this. And I don't have her quotes with me. I'll try to remember that. She says that her father was unable to treat all of his wives the same. And she's doing that in the context of people saying he has a favorite wife. She kind of indicates that it was very difficult for him to be a polygamist. And if you look at the... You know, so many of the wives just had few children by him. So you'd kind of assume by that, and I'm not an expert on this, but I assume that he visited them less than Emmeline Free, who did have a large family. There is some indication, too, at the end of her life, Emmeline, she died before Brigham Young, was probably not as happy about the situation as when he married Amelia, fulsome. Sousa comments on the two women. She says that Emmeline, first, she says Emmeline was not nice to, she was not sweet or nice. But Amelia was. Sousa thought Amelia was wonderful, which is really different than Annalisa. Annalisa, though she only met her twice, thought she was really awful. But so there is some, I guess on one level you could say that Emmeline was maybe the closer to him in, I don't know, what would you say, in a romantic sense, but that Amelia later on replaced her in that. The wife that we think was a drug addict is Emmeline Free, who had the 10 children. And we think that she might have, because of her frequent childbirth, she might have been given drugs for that. Or the depression afterwards. I don't know about that. Another interesting thing about her family, and I've met several of the descendants of them. If you're here, I hope you won't think that I'm trying to down her, but Sousa says that she didn't believe in the gospel, and she allowed her daughters, who had been to the temple, to cut the sleeves off of their garments. And to Sousa, that was the most horrible thing. And several of her daughters left Mormonism, became involved in several of the churches here, but the Unitarian Church. And from her family, from Emmeline's family, are the ones that were the more rebellious children.
That's it.
Two of her daughters were part of that. There were five children. One was the son of Eliza Burgess, who moved to Provo. And then the other two were the two older daughters who were by the first marriage. Those daughters were older than many of these wives. Elizabeth Ellsworth was married before they left Nauvoo. So, and some of Brigham Young's wives were just children, like Amelia was just a child in Nauvoo. So those were the five that sued over. But the two of her daughters did. But another one of her daughters left Mormonism. So quite a few of them did. Yes. Okay, let me answer the first one, which is easier, the White House. It actually was in two places. But it generally, where the Alda Club is today on South Temple, on the corner where the apartments are, it was where the schoolhouse was, and then the White House was next. But the family sold the property, and John W. Young bought it, and he wanted the house, so he moved the house down the street just a little bit. Down South Temple. It's not very far, actually. It was off the... And it's funny they could move this old house, but they didn't. Okay, non-conjugal. This is the biggest issue about how do you count Brigham Young's wives. Most people want to say, well, if you're a wife, you have sexual relations with them. But I don't have any way of knowing which ones had sexual relations. I just have two stories. One is Sousa Young Gates apparently was tired of people asking her that because she said, we didn't talk about that. in the home I grew up in. So I think that's kind of fantastic that the wives were blind outside M lines. I think they were not that. But the other thing is, we've had to kind of say that, and Leonard Arrington started using that, and that's the way he explained the wives that didn't have children. I have a hard time saying just because a woman didn't have a child, they didn't live together. Naima Twiss, who was the woman in charge of the kitchens, was 21 years old when she married him, and she lived all her life there. So I don't know. So maybe I shouldn't have used that in the paper, except there were women who didn't have children. There were women who were older and maybe didn't have conjugal relations with Brigham Young. Eliza Arsenault might be one of those. So I don't know. I don't know. That doesn't really answer your question, but... What they did is they offered each of the members of the family and the widows a certain amount of money to settle the estate. And most of them accepted that, but five children. So what they did with those five children, they offered them more money, and they accepted that, and then they excommunicated all five of them from the church. Because what they saw it as saying, because the church was trying to separate what the church owned and what the Brigham Young owned. So. Florence Jacobson. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. That's how Florence Jacobson was able to save it. She said this is sacred because the Young Women's Organization was started here. Brigham Young started it essentially around his daughter. Levina says she didn't need a reason. She might have had more influence than Harold B. Lee. She was related to more general authorities than he was. So yes, that's where that was. That's where that happened, and it did spread throughout the church. Do you know, this is a big interest in mine, because I'm interested in men's history, and it's very difficult to know. I'm going to try to track that, so I can't answer it. The boys were expected to work. We know they were expected to work, and so they weren't around the house as much. We haven't been able to find any of their reminiscences. There was also a big group of the boys who left and went to college in the East, and some of those, a few of them, stayed out of Utah. But what their life was when they were small is something we don't really know.
Would you like to bring Brigham Young Jr. come through? Was it clear from an early age that he was going to assume a role of prominence?
Marianne Angell. So he was a teenager when his father entered polygamy. I think there was a feeling in the church, and some of you might know more about this than I, that there was some blood had a lot to do with your standing, and there was a feeling that the sons of general authorities should take prominent roles in the church. Heber J. Grant is the first president of the church that didn't ordain one of his sons an apostle. And that's the thing. He didn't have all his adult children were daughters. And wouldn't it have been nice if he had ordained one of them, huh? They were very active in the church. So that, of course, two of his were ordained apostles, Brigham Young Jr. and John W. Young, who was never in the quorum that was in the First Presidency. I think there was a feeling, yes, that they needed to step up and be. Paul?
I know you've worked on this a little bit before, but it's problematic. But where are you in identifying out of those children, how many stay within Mormonism?
Well, I gave a paper on that. I think you were in that session. It's very difficult to document how people were active, and I can only kind of judge. I said in that paper that I think a third of his children became either inactive in the church or left the church. A third were very, very active, and, you know, like Susan, some of the other women were very involved. And maybe a third were just kind of members of the church like I am. But, you know, it's really hard to say, and I've gone to look and see where their funeral was held. If it wasn't held in a Mormon church, there's a few that were held, and then I tried to look and see that they left the church. But it's kind of difficult, and I also hate to be judgmental. Well, I think it probably was very difficult. I think the key for the sons and the daughters were their mothers. I think their mothers, and as we talk about the activity and stuff, I think you can see their mother's attitude towards polygamy, towards the church, towards Brigham Young, really is played out in the children's lives. But I think it was difficult. I think it was difficult to be a second-generation Mormon. And I wrote a paper about Lucinda Haywood, who became a Christian the first Christian Science practitioner here in Salt Lake. Her name is Lucinda Haywood Kimball. And I kind of get into that idea, how difficult it was for the children of the first generation. Because I think their parents expected Christ to come soon, and they'd put all their energy in building the kingdom. And how do you deal with the second generation? Lucinda's husband, Frank Kimball, was a close friend of Heber J. Grant. And Heber J. Grant said, I could have gone the same way Frank did, which meant left Mormonism. But because it was very, you know, it was very difficult to be a second generation. One of the things that was hard is the men didn't have a lot of time for these children, and they learned about polygamy when they were in their middle age. So their children were much, much younger than them. That's the example of Heber C. Kimball and J. Golden Kimball. Most of these men were old men when their children were growing up. So that's difficult. So I think there's complex, but there's the second generation problem. And they tried to start solving that by giving the priesthood to the Aaronic priesthood to the young man, having the young men, the associations, the young women's association, the primary. But that was kind of late in the church, you know, trying to teach these people to be good Mormons. Levina. Well, the main thing I want to do is introduce these women to the world so that people can understand that they were people who were interesting, people who had women who, and that they were not all the same. They didn't have the same ideas. I think we talk about, you know, polygamous women or people's wives in stereotypes. So I'd like to break those stereotypes and make sure that they're... But we get to know them a little better.
So will you be going to the second generation, looking at their children and their children, and
their parents? It sounds like I should, doesn't it? Especially when we look at Emmeline's and say, well, you know, maybe she caused their children to be less faithful in the church. And I think maybe we need to look at all of them. Margaret's son... Morris, you know, he was essentially raised by a single a mother, you know, that several of the women had one child. Eliza Burgess had one son. Margaret Pierce had one son. And I'm sure that made a difference of how he was raised and stuff.
Were any of those children taken out of while they were small by their mother?
No.
There are no children.
Yeah, in fact, they all grew up a part of this big family. And they all went to his birthday, I'm sure, and many, many years after. And in fact, today, the granddaughters celebrate his birthday. So some of them grew up and left, but they were part of this family when they were children. Nine divorces. Some of these women were young women when they married him in Nauvoo in the temple, and they married people more their age when they got to Utah. There doesn't seem to be any at all hostility that he had towards them for not remaining in their family. They seem to be generally part of the group here. But nine, you know, the marriage left.
What did you account for how folks have to show about their relationship?
You know, that would be interesting. I need to do that study. I really like reading Emily Partridge's, because she's her work, because she talks about having to go to the and get food from the workers there, and how that made her mad. So we need to look at that to see how that.
There are accounts for the household.
Yes, they're very detailed. You know, he had these wonderful clerks whose all job it was to record everything. So the detailed account books are available. Stop marrying people. Oh, well, no, he actually continued. I'll just... the last... his last daughter, Mary Van Cott's daughter, Fanny, it's funny, the last child was named Fanny, was born... 7 years before he died. But yeah, he was 70 when the child was born. That's correct. Huh? How old was his wife? Mary Van Cott. I can tell you that. I was looking to see. He married Hannah Tapfield King, the last woman that I know that he married. Um,
though Hannah did not live in the Lion House, right?
That's right. She did not leave her husband, her non-Mormon husband. She married him so that she could go to the celestial kingdom. Her husband was not a Mormon. They'd come from England to Utah, and she was very prominent. Wrote a lot of poetry that was published and stuff. But she was getting old and decided that her husband wasn't going to church. She was going to not be able to go to the celestial kingdom. So in 72, she was sealed to Brigham Young. I would say that's a non-conjugal relationship. So. She was born in 1844. So in 1870, how old was she? Her name's Mary Van Cott. She was born in 1844, which would be when the year Joseph Smith was killed. Yeah. She had been married before. She had a child before by James Cobb, and her first this is a very complex family. Her child by her first marriage married Brigham Young's son, John W. Young. Luella Cobb married, and Augusta was their grandmother. Augusta was married to Brigham Young. Brigham Young married her son's ex-wife, and John W. Young married his father's stepdaughter. Well, do you know, we think that he never had breakfast with any of his wives. Most of the accounts say that he had breakfast at 10 o'clock, and all the wives had their breakfast, and all the children were gone at that time. So apparently he had it alone. And then the next meal he had it was at 6 o'clock. And we know that he wanted all the family that could come to be there at 6 o'clock. So they had that all together. I think we need to give this room up.